Welcome to Grace and Truth with Father George Rutler. Join Father Rutler as he talks about Catholic culture and doctrine, including grace, goodness, laughter, and humility. Here now is Father Rutler.
I've been speaking in these talks about grace and truth, one way or another, but all in tribute to what St. John says in the opening of the fourth gospel. The law came through Moses, grace and truth through Jesus Christ. Law, the ordering principle of the world in the natural order as natural law, and the ordering principle of the soul and its behavior as moral law. But this is empowered by God's presence, His grace, and the explanation of who He is, His truth. When the soul is full of grace and truth, the soul sings. This is an instinct of the human condition. When we're happy, we sing. And when we're sad, we sing. The one kind of song praises order, and the other song mourns the collapse of an order. Music is heavenly laughter come to earth. When our Lord was born, the angels sang. The heavens opened, and a great joy was heard. Peace on earth to men of goodwill. In other words, it is only the soul in harmony with God that can sing the song, that can understand the song. Laughter is a moral reality, and we can tell it by the fact that it can either be pleasant or unsettling. When people laugh at something that is really funny, in a good spirit, it's the best medicine. It cheers the listener. But we can be horrified, deeply unsettled, by the sound of people laughing at what is evil, disordered, and obscene. One statistic has it that the average child laughs 113 times a day. I don't know who this statistician was. We have to take these figures with a grain of salt. But adults laugh on an average of 11 times a day. Whatever we make of the numbers, the general principle is palpable. Children laugh a lot more than grown-ups. Something happens in the process of growing up, and I will not call it maturity, but something happens in the process of the years taking its toll that diminishes laughter. Only God's grace can restore that laughter. Without holy laughter, we're not human. Thomas Aquinas said a definition of a human being is the ability to laugh, risibility. Animals do not have it. Hyenas may sound like they're laughing, but they aren't. We're projecting the gift of laughter onto creatures when we think they are. Oh, they delight in God, and God delights in them in other ways. But we, through a harmony of intellect and will, are able to laugh, perceive order and the incongruity of disorder. Our great Catholic voice in this century, the journalist G.K. Chesterton, said that almost without exception, the greatest philanthropists in the world lack two things: laughter and humility. He was very suspicious of millionaires. But he did say that the philanthropist, with all his good works, is not pleasing to God or really to man unless he can also spread with his money and medicine and public institutions God's grace and God's truth. Andrew Carnegie, probably the richest man in the world in Chesterton's time, drove at Chesterton almost to distraction. Chesterton said, "Andrew Carnegie is a good man, but he could be so much more if only someone were to roll him in a barrel down the street." The two things lacking in secular humanism: laughter and humility. Laughter, the gift of grace, the manifestation of grace. Humility, the gift of truth, the manifestation of truth. Just as it is in our better nature to sing, so is it in our better nature to put words together in poetry. In the late 17th century in Southampton, England, there was a boy who was addicted to verse. He had a hard time stopping at about 1680. This Isaac Watts watched a mouse by the fireplace and said, "The little mouse, for want of stairs, ran up a rope to say his prayers. His father told him to cut it out." The family had had enough of this. He replied, "Father, father, pity take, and I will no more verses make." He didn't keep his promise. He became the father of English hymnody. He wrote hundreds and hundreds of hymns. We still sing some of them. "Joy to the World," "O God, our help in ages past, when I survey the wondrous cross." He wrote the words. He didn't write the music. The two go together. Grace and truth go together. They have their own laws of composition. But when we take the best music and the most truthful words and combine them and offer them to God, then we have sacred music. The 20th century Swiss theologian Hans Urs von Balthasar, great Catholic mind, wrote much about music and all the mysteries of beauty in relation to God's creation, was a good friend of the Calvinist theologian Karl Barth. And while they didn't agree on all religious doctrines, they agreed on Mozart. They frequently got together and listened. Balthasar had one of the most phenomenal minds I can think of in his generation or in the modern age. He so memorized the Mozartian corpus that he threw his vitrola out finally. He just listened to whatever he wanted to in his head, playing it in his mind. It's extraordinary. He said rather whimsically once that, "I suppose that the angels play Bach when they are performing for God, but I'm quite certain that amongst themselves they sing Mozart." Well, tastes can vary, but it is only the barbarian who says that all taste is subjective. There is a hierarchy of truths. There is a hierarchy of standards for the beautiful, the good, and the true. And if we do not conform ourselves to God as the source of these things, then we lose that triad. Beauty becomes mere aestheticism. The truth becomes pedantry. And the good becomes mere sentimentality. A computer company recently has had an advertisement on radio and television for some new email system, playing very lush music, wonderful music of Mozart. But the advertisement says, well, where do you want to go? What they don't realize is that the Mozart music is from the Requiem, and the Latin words are all about the souls of the damned going into the acrid flames of hell. That is mere aestheticism. The words and the music have to go together. They have to fit the moment. The church raises our artistic capacity for making harmony and expressing truth to its highest capacity at the central moment of civilization, and that is the offering of the Eucharistic sacrifice of the altar. It is here that the angels and the saints gather together singing the truth of God come to earth. The Second Vatican Council said in that moment, it's the song of the heavenly Jerusalem, come into our midst. It's not out of a vain aestheticism that the church has promoted music. It is because grace and truth has come to us through Christ. And that means that we sing. And we not only sing nice sounding music, but we sing words of truth. The music must serve the words. So the church is given a preference of place to plain chant or Gregorian chant, because with its mathematical symmetry it never overwhelms the music. The sentimentalists let music run away with the soul without obeying what is being said. No sacred song sings lies. And the more the vision of heaven becomes palpable, the nobler both the sound of the music and the verse. In the first millennium, at the end of the first millennium, the beginning of the second, there was a pope who was an accomplished musician as well as a theologian, Sylvester II. He had served as bishop in Reims, in Gaul, in France, in Ravenna, and then Rome. Some of his critics, trying to explain his brilliance, said he must have sold his soul to the devil. And they cited the fact that he had been in three dioceses, beginning with ours, as proof of this kind of diabolism, a kind of nonsense. It made the Pope laugh. He helped develop the modern pipe organ. But more importantly, he wrote verse to be sung, verses about God, and everything he said, although it had to follow the laws of meter and rhyme, conformed to the truth of the gospel. Cardinal Newman in the 19th century spoke about the development of doctrine, and he gave certain principles by which we can analyze how doctrine legitimately is re-expressed, re-exhibited from age to age in new language, but always consistent to its essential integrity. And one of the criteria for authentic development of doctrine was what he called continuity of type. In other words, the essential message is never changed. I can change the language in which I say it. I can alter the imagery that I use to express it. But the fundamental principle never changes. In the Counter-Reformation, in one of the most exuberant periods of Catholic artistic life, at the time of the Council of Trent, Palestrina promoted a system of intricate harmonies and descants we call polyphony. Pope Marcellus finally assented to this, but he insisted that there be a cantus firmus, a consistent melody, a theme, which the harmonies may decorate, but which remains consistent, audible, and predominant. In so doing, he gave us a musical model of what Newman meant by the continuity of type. All great music is harmonious. It is not a principle of discord. It does not promote evil passion. It has a finale. It's part of a symmetry with a goal. Our friend Chesterton, whom we've quoted, said, and perhaps with somewhat exaggeration, because he didn't like jazz music, that jazz was the song of the treadmill. Well, that may have been an arbitrary expression of taste. But he was expressing that essential principle that great music must have a goal, must attain a finale. Plato, you remember, banned from his ideal republic chorobantic music, which was music which deliberately, through the use of repetitious drum beats and nonsensical words, dimmed the intellect and inflamed the lower passions. Is it an exaggeration to say that he was talking about rock music or rap music? Where is the grace in rock music? Where is the truth in rap music? Again, I'm not tethering ourselves to any arbitrary expression of taste, but I am saying that the Catholic Christian must be committed to the exhibition and manifestation of grace and truth through the forms of art accessible to us. It was Mr. Frank Sinatra, as a matter of fact, who said that rock music was the most brutal, ugly, desperate, and vicious form of expression that it had ever been his misfortune to hear. So you're not getting it from me. You're getting it from Frank Sinatra. Well, whether we cite Frank Sinatra or G.K. Chesterton or Pope Sylvester, we have to cite St. John. The law came through Moses, but grace and truth through Jesus Christ. Cardinal Ratzinger has told us, in much of the wonderful writing he's done on music, that we have to begin with the Gloria of the angels at the Incarnation, the sound heard from heaven, that celestial laughter which cheered that cold, neglected stable. He points out that in the traditional old liturgy of the Mass, the canon was said silently as the Sanctus, the Holy, Holy, Holy was sung. And that was not because the Sanctus was so long, you had to start the canon and get on with it. It was because the celestial music of the cherubim accompanies, on the part of the gathered church, the voice of the priest is the altar Christus, offering in the name of Christ the perfect sacrifice of the body and blood. So everyone doesn't have to be singing the same thing at the same time, the choir complimenting, the clergy and singing its part, as the congregation sings its part, are all part, a greater part, of this harmony, a kind of collective liturgical polyphony. So we have to wash out of our minds a lot of the more recent liturgical nonsense we've had. We have been afflicted with some of the most banal, brutal, ugly, destructive and vicious substitutes for sacred music in our own generation. Nevertheless, there perdures that essential vision which motivates all the saints, and it is the vision of the celestial laughter of heaven come into our midst. In the practical order, then, it is the tradition of the Church to discourage the use of percussion instruments through the same sensibility that motivated Plato to ban chorobanticism from the ideal republic. For that, percussionism amplifies the rhythm of the untransfigured passions. Rather, the strings and the wind instruments are appropriate to the liturgy. The piano is essentially, although it has strings, a percussion instrument, and therefore it is inappropriate in the sacred liturgy. And so too, since all the music is part of a gathered offering to God, it's inappropriate for the singers to face the faithful. The faithful are the essential singers, and therefore it's far more fitting that the choir should be dispersed amongst the people, and at best in a loft behind the people, both for theological, spiritual, and practical acoustical reasons. A confrontation between a leader of song and the people sends a wrong psychological message. I can't think of anything really more defeating to public singing than being confronted by someone waving his arms and singing at us. These matters aside, and some of them can be disputed, there abides the fact that in order to make worthy music for the courts of heaven, we need laughter and we need humility. Not silly, banal laughter, sometimes expressed in the form of false informality and applause in church. No, in the sacred space, the divine laughter must cause a reverent and solemn silence. And so too, if we are humble, we will not congratulate ourselves in church. We will not entertain ourselves in church. We will offer the song of the angels and nothing less. John Henry Newman was a musician as well as one of the great theologians of Catholic history. I fully expect that he may someday be declared a doctor of the church. He loved playing the violin. And even when he got to be an old man, he most prized as a gift a violin, which he played and played until his fingers became too arthritic. In one of his sermons, he says, in words which are a sacred song themselves, is it possible that that inexhaustible evolution and disposition of notes so rich, yet so simple, so intimate, yet so regulated, so various, yet so majestic, should be a mere sound which is gone and perishes? It is not so. It cannot be, he says. No, they have emerged from some higher sphere. They are the outpourings of eternal harmony in the medium of created sound. They are echoes from home. And by home, we know he means heaven, our real home. They are the voice, he says, of angels, or the Magnificat of saints, or the living law of divine governance, or the divine attributes. Something are they beyond themselves which we cannot compass, which we cannot utter, though mortal man, and he perhaps not otherwise distinguished above his fellows, have the gift of eliciting them.
Please join us again next time for Grace and Truth with Father George Rutler on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.